The headlines, Beijing says its proposal on the crisis in Ukraine is aimed at promoting political settlement. A new study shows nearly 200 U.S. banks are at risk of meltdown after the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. And Sudan's political factions agree to form a new transitional government. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Chinese president says that his country's proposal for solving the ongoing crisis in Ukraine represents the unity of the global community's views. Xi Jinping says Beijing's initiative is aimed at neutralizing the consequences of the Ukraine crisis and promoting a political settlement. He added that finding a rational solution to the crisis hinges on the concept of sustainable security and continuation of dialogue in an equal and pragmatic manner. Xi's remarks came ahead of his planned visit to Russia. China put forth its 12-point proposal to settle the Ukraine conflict last month on the first anniversary of the war. The initiative calls for a ceasefire and talks between the warring sides. A senior Russian official has warned of horrible consequences for international law after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for the country's president. Deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says the ICC seeks to put on trial the president of a nuclear power, which is not a participant in the court. Medvedev says that this amounts to the collapse of principles of law. Russian Foreign Ministry earlier said that the arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin lacks any meaning or legal value for Moscow. The Hague-based ICC can only exercise jurisdiction within the countries that have signed to its agreement. Russia withdrew its signature in 2016. Western leaders, including the U.S. president, have also accused Russia of war crimes, a charge that Moscow rejects. A study finds that nearly 190 U.S. banks are at significant risk of collapse after the Silicon Valley and Signature banks crashed over a week ago. A survey by economists from four prestigious universities shows these banks will face a meltdown if their depositors are to withdraw their funds quickly. Such withdrawals are likely due to fears about uninsured deposits. According to economists, the Federal Reserve aggressive interest rate hikes to curb rampant inflation have eroded the value of bank assets. They say this has, quote, very significantly increased the fragility of the banking system. The economists are warning that even deposits insured by the Federal Reserve are at risk as its insurance funds are starting to incur losses. And Iran's top security official has visited Iraq. He says Tehran-Baghdad security ties must first and foremost include bringing to justice those involved in the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In our news review program, we took a closer look at this issue.
Time now for the news review section. Stay tuned. Iran says that the prosecution of those involved in the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani is a top priority in security cooperation between Tehran and Baghdad. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, made the comment during an official visit to Iraq. He said that the passage of time should not reduce the significance of the assassination. He added that the U.S. continues to destabilize the region through its mischievous acts that he described as something intolerable which should be ended. Now, for his part, Secretary of Iraq's National Security, Qasem al-Urouji, said, Baghdad is committed to a parliamentary legislation that calls for all foreign forces to be expelled. He added that major parts of the legislation have already been implemented. The Iran official is in Iraq for talks on bilateral security cooperation. Now, to put this to discussion, let me invite a couple of guests. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, is joining me from Islamabad. Also with me is Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator out of Beirut. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Mohsen Abbas, we have Mr. Shamkhani saying that, and as you also well know, that the U.S. is still continuing to destabilize the region, and these destabilizing moves should come to an end. Let's talk about this, and also the fact that, as also the National Security Council Secretary said, that the passage of time does not make forget what the U.S. did, and I'm referring to the assassination of General Soleimani.
Well, I think all of the points Mr. Shamkhani has made are reiterating Iran's very clear understanding that it is the United States of America, along with its Zionist ally, Israel, that is causing most of the destabilization through all sorts of kind of clandestine means. Deep state is busy working to finance all sorts of groups. Just to name a few, of course, is ISIS-K. That's the one that everybody knows. But lesser known ones are relevant in this particular negotiation and dialogue between Iraq and Iran. And those are namely groups, for instance, like the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, Kurdish Democratic Party, all of whose HQs are in Iraq. And it's these groups and it's kind of their connection with dissident Iranian Kurds, if you like, who have been operating on the borders of Iran and creating incursions, making huge terrorist issues for Iran, and it's so much so that Iran had to act, and it acted with precision missiles, suicide drones, which hit the bases of the KDPI and others, and basically over 14 people, I think, were killed in those attacks, and 58 were wounded. One, significantly, was a U.S. so-called citizen. Deep state was there indeed. So the fact is that Iran is primarily getting Iraq to sign deals to say, look, sort this problem out on our borders, because it's being manipulated and used by the Zionist, Anglo-Zionist Empire in order to destabilize Iran through their Kurdish proxies.
Okay. Now, Mr. Saleh, what would it take, in your opinion, for perpetrators, those behind the assassination of Iran's top General Soleimani, who played a major role in helping Iraqis fight Daesh terrorists, what would it take for perpetrators to be brought to justice?
It's about time for the Iraq government to take the decision. The parliament, the Iraqi parliament, has taken a legislative decision that all forces, foreign forces, should go out from Iraq, especially the Americans, who committed this historical and hysterical, crime against one of the officials, of the great official, the martyr Qasem Soleimani. So it's probably they have to do something. They have to act against the Americans and brought those who committed this crime into justice. The Iraqis, especially the officials, they have to cooperate with the Iranian officials in order to send this big message to the authorities, especially the Democratic, who are having now a lot of problems with Donald Trump and his administration. The Iraqis are responsible for getting not only the truth, that which is clear and discerned, especially Trump and his aides, and whoever cooperated to take action in this crime, I guess they have to be brought to their justice.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. Mohsen Abbas in Islamabad and Mohsen Saleh in Beirut.
U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. It marked a major turning point for the region and the U.S. itself. Unbeknownst to the U.S., the invasion would mark the beginning of the U.S. losing its influence in West Asia altogether. The U.S. allies would also realize a declining U.S. power and how being a U.S. ally would not mean much unless security is taken into the hands of regional countries.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
Then U.S. President George W. Bush's 2003 decision to oust Saddam Hussein by force under the false pretext of WMDs. The U.S. unleashed its war machine on Iraq, and the country and the wider West Asia region would never be the same.
ارتكب المجرم الأرعن بوش الصغير هو وأعوانه جريمته التي كان يتوعد بها العراق.
The U.S. still contends with the consequences of invading Iraq 20 years ago.
There's not many who would come to the defense of this and think that this was a wise intervention. That, again, I mean, I think mostly because there are two kinds of critiques. One, which is there was no justification for doing it all in the first place, or which is one kind of critique. And the other is that, well, there was a justification, but only if you were capable of making sure that what came after it was not worse than what happened before. And the combination of the two makes this pretty flawed.
What came after depends on who you ask in the American administrations, past and present. Then U.S. President George Bush Jr. had a rosy assessment.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein was a ruthless dictator. His fate, in some way, was justified. Yet John Bolton believed removing Saddam justified the costs. But what was not justified was the U.S. forcing its version of democracy on Iraq.
Now, when it comes to wars, the U.S. has not won a war in a very long time. Take the cases of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The U.S. has not been able to manage defeating the other side. This shows how the U.S. military is not capable of winning a war, which could be part of the reason behind the U.S. losing its clout with regional countries.
The U.S. invasion of Iraq was the beginning of major unraveling of U.S. policy in West Asia. It also revealed the true colors of a brutal regime. First, the cost of U.S. involvement, pretty vast. According to a 2020 paper by a co-director of the Cost of War Project at Brown University, the U.S. price tag was nearly $2 trillion. That figure could be as high as $4 trillion. Then the human cost. U.S. soldiers, about 5,000. Iraqi civilians, over 1 million. The U.S. failure in Iraq was on multiple fronts. From the tortures at Iraqi prisons, like Abu Ghraib, which showed the brutality of the U.S. regime, to the waning support from the Iraqi population, the U.S. realized it had to pull out of Iraq.
Today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
I just decided we didn't want to do this stuff anymore. And that began, to be honest, I mean, that began with President Obama declaring that he was going to pull all forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, another U.S. debacle. The nail in the coffin for a failed U.S. foreign policy.
And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over.
We're dealing very well with the Taliban. They're very tough. They're very smart. They're very sharp. But, you know, it's been 19 years, and even they are tired of fighting.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
Which brings us to today, where the U.S. influence in West Asia has reached a standstill. Nothing could be more evident of that than the recent Iran-Saudi resumption of diplomatic ties. Ironic that the country that the U.S. invaded back in 2003, Iraq, was the one that mediated between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which may lead to the ouster of U.S. troops from the region altogether.
Sudan's political factions have agreed to form a new transitional government on April 11th, paving the way for the return of civilian rule. The spokesperson for the signatories to the agreement says that the first step is to form a committee that will establish a draft new constitution. The committee will include 9 members from the civilian groups and 1 from the army and another from a powerful paramilitary force. The committee members will sign the transitional framework for the agreement early next month, followed by a constitutional declaration on April 6th. Sudan has been gripped by political turmoil following a coup in 2021, which ousted the country's civilian government. Since then, the military leaders have been negotiating a deal with political parties to restore civilian government. A pro-Syria sit-in has been held in Rome and a number of capitals across the world as part of a campaign called End the Siege. The initiative was in solidarity with the Syrian people who are suffering from the sanctions imposed on their country by the West. Iran marks the 72nd anniversary of the nationalization of its oil industry, which was a significant step in the country's independence from the West. On March 20, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh to nationalize the oil industry. The initiative made Iran the first country in the Middle East to reclaim its oil industry from colonial powers. In a relation, Britain and the U.S. states, the United States, that is, imposed sanctions against Iran's oil sector and later colluded to stage a coup against the ex-prime minister's government in a 1953 coup. The CIA declassified documents of the incident in 2013, confirming Washington's footprints in the military overthrow of Mossadegh. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This Turkmen rug looks gorgeous. Great design. Actually, my today's destination is not the colorful, fantastic bazaars of Golestan province. I have made a trip to this province in order to visit a monument called Gumbad-e-Qaboos, which is considered to be a masterpiece of Iranian architecture. This great monument is located in the city of Gumbad-e-Qaboos. I promise this would be a perfect trip. Stay with me. Gumbad-e-Qaboos Tower is a monument in the city of Gumbad-e-Qaboos in Golestan province, northern Iran. It marks the grave of Ziyarid ruler Qaboos and was built during his lifetime. It is a cylindrical tomb tower that reaches 72 meters and can be seen from some 30 kilometers away. The monument has an interior diameter of 9.67 meters at its base. The inscription bands on the tower, written in rhymed prose, states that Qaboos ordered the foundation of the tower built during his lifetime. The tower is entirely constructed of fine quality baked bricks, which has been turned golden by the sun rays. The only decoration in the tower comprises two inscription bands which ring the building above the doorway and below the roof. Each band is divided into 10 panels, one set between each pair of buttresses. Though the tower is meant to be Qaboos Mausoleum, there is no body buried inside, similar to other tomb towers of northern Iran. This tower looks brilliant even from this distance.
This tower is actually the symbol of the city. It has universal reputation and is considered as a masterpiece of Iranian architecture.
Thanks for the information, sir.
Well, here we arrive. Have a nice tour.
Thank you. Well, I am now in a garden which has placed Gumbad-e-Qaboos Tower. This tower is actually situated on a hill. A green, beautiful atmosphere. Very beautiful. You know, here I have an appointment with Mr. Rahmani, Professor of Architecture and History. I think I saw him, yes. There he is. Hello, sir. It's good to see you.
Hello. My pleasure.
What distinguishes this tower from other structures?
The only material used in this tower is baked brick and Saruj traditional water-resistant mortar. This tower has no cement, no metal frame, and no iron. The red baked bricks have been turned golden by the rays of sun.
Oh, great.
This tower is the only monument which survived the Mongol invasion.
Now, let me take a closer look at this tower. Gumbad-e-Qaboos is established on a very firm foundation. It has survived even after strong earthquakes, and there is no sign of damage on the tower. Remarkable. Let me go inside. Well, it's simple, just like the outer part of the tower. No decoration. The factor of firmness is the most important thing that has been taken into consideration. Decoration and beauty have come second in the eyes of the architect. And outside the tower, there is a circular site, which there is something wonderful about it. If you come to this place, say something or sing a song, your voice will be echoed. Let me try it. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Oh. 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 Everybody is watching. I feel so embarrassed. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. In this edition, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it is filing a lawsuit against the Israeli regime in the International Criminal Court. This comes after the ICC announced that It has made its decision to investigate the Israeli occupation and war crimes against Palestinians. Hamas sees this as a step forward on the path of achieving justice, but at the same time, the regime has intensified its crackdown against Palestinians, and the violence has left about 90 Palestinians dead so far only this year. In this edition, we will scrutinize the different aspects of this move and how it can help Palestinians in their plight. And in order to do that, we are joined by Khaled Barakat, a journalist and activist who is joining us live from Vancouver. Also, we have with us Mukaymer Abusada, professor of political science from Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with our guests in Vancouver. Now, this does seem like a step forward, but how optimistic should we be, sir?
Well, not very much, because of the past experience with the ICC and with international agencies in general. Historically, some of these organizations might rule in favor of Palestinians, but these kind of decisions don't really have teeth in order to implement their decisions, let alone when it's not a decision within, that carries political weight, or that it's by the ICC itself that its credibility is on stake. In fact, it acts these days as a tool for NATO and Western powers. Palestinians must use all arenas in order to expose the Israeli occupation, absolutely. And they have been doing so for many, many years. But we're not optimistic about any of this, although it's important to persuade, these kind of cases and to put Israel on trial because of its war crimes. The building of colonies is war crimes. The massacres that Israel has been doing in Palestine for the past 75 years, their war crimes. I mean, it's very obvious cases, but even in United Nations General Assembly or United Nations Security Council, their resolutions were never implemented. Not one single resolution by these institutions was implemented, and that's because Israel is always covered and backed by the United States and Western imperialist powers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barakat. Let's bring in our guest from Gaza City, Professor Abusada. Now, our guest from Vancouver does not seem very optimistic, but still these are baby steps forward in order to push for the rights of Palestinians. Let's not forget that, according to all international laws, legitimate resistance is something that is recognized. What is your opinion?
Well, first of all, many thanks for having me in your program, Spotlight. And second thing, let me start by saying that Hamas, as a Palestinian resistance group, cannot take Israel to the ICC. As a matter of fact, it's Palestine, the Palestine state, which is an observer state at the UN General Assembly, can prosecute Israel and take Israel to the International Criminal Court. And this is what the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian, the state of Palestine, has been trying to do lately since Palestine came an observer state at the UN General Assembly in November of 2012, which is 11 years ago. And also Palestine joined the ICC in 2016. And there are Palestinian requests of the ICC to prosecute Israeli crimes and Israeli appalling atrocities against the Palestinian people, whether Israel war crimes or crimes against humanity, which have been committed against the Palestinian civilian population in the West Bank and Gaza over more than 55 years of Israeli occupation and Israeli aggression against the Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. So, yes, the Palestinians can do that as since, as I mentioned, Palestine is a member of the UNRL Assembly and also has joined the ICC. But let me also add one more thing, that the ICC has started preliminary investigation a few years ago when the ex-ICC Attorney General Fatou Bensouda was the Attorney General of the ICC. It opened a preliminary investigation in Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. But unfortunately, the current Attorney General of the ICC, Mr. Karim Khan, to be honest with you, he has failed to do his job as an AG of the ICC. He hasn't done what he is requested to do to investigate Israeli crimes and Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians. Let me show you the double standards of the ICC. When the ICC just issued yesterday an arrest warrant against the Russian President Vladimir Putin
because of Russian invasion
of Ukraine.
Professor, I'm going to cut you off right there because this is another issue we want to discuss in depth, and the double standards of ICC itself is a whole different story. But before we get into the ICC itself and how it is going to carry out this whole investigation, let's talk more about Palestinians and, of course, the Israeli regime. You did mention that Palestinians are a member of the UN General Assembly. They are a member of the ICC, and it is completely the legal pathways, actually, are open there for the Palestinians. But Israel is not a member of the ICC. How does this work out?
Well, it's true that Israel has not signed the Rome Statute that established the ICC. Israel is not a member of the ICC, just like Russia that is not a member of the ICC. But Israel being not being a member of the ICC doesn't mean that Israel can escape legal prosecution by the ICC. Since Israel has committed, according to the ICC and according to many international organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who have basically indicated in many of their reports that Israel has committed war crimes against the Palestinians, especially in the Israeli aggression against Gaza in 2021, in May of 2021. In addition to that, Israeli settlement activity in the Palestinian territory is classified as a war crime that is in contradiction of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So what I'm trying to say to you is that, yes, Israel is not a member of the ICC, but that's still Israeli officials or Israeli military commanders will be subjected to ICC prosecution, and Israel cannot escape its responsibility for not being a member of the ICC.
Okay, so our guest from Vancouver, in your opinion, if the ICC does issue a ruling, how likely is that ruling to be implemented?
It will not be implemented. It will just carry a sentimental value. I'm not saying it's not important. It's absolutely important for Palestinians to expose Israeli war crimes, to have this on record, because it's part of the history of the Palestinian struggle. But the problem with this is that the Palestinian Authority is counting on this as the only strategy it has. And the resistance should not fall into this. The resistance strategy should include its political, diplomatic, and popular work. But at the end of the day, what forced occupiers and colonizers to end their project is power. It's resistance. It's an actual turning the occupation into a losing project. And the other problem is that the Palestinians have been members of the United Nations, represented by the PLO since 1974, and the PLO as a legitimate representative body of the Palestinian people officially. Palestinians were playing a much more political and effective role in the United Nations and on international level when they were representing a Palestinian liberation movement and not merely a Palestinian state, almost like a decorative position than a real position. We know, for example, that Israel is the only nuclear power in the Middle East, yet no one investigates Israel. Why? Because not because Israel is not a signatory of the Rome Pact, but because Israel enjoy the covers and the political back and support of the United States, particularly United States and Western powers. So, yes, Palestinians might achieve a symbolic victory here and there in terms of international, you know, agencies, but it's not really, it should not be, you know, a strategy for us in terms of the liberation process.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Professor was also discussing the double standards of the ICC. So, Professor, back to that topic. You just mentioned that the ICC has issued an arrest warrant for Putin, and you were talking about the double standards of the ICC. Let's talk more about that, and with respect to Palestinians, how likely is it for us to see a similar reaction from the ICC?
Yes, but let me just also add one more note here that members of the ICC are 132 countries out of 194 countries. So not all members of the UN General Assembly are members or signatory to the Rome Statute. So only 132 countries are members or has joined the ICC. Speaking of the ICC double standards, well, the international community in general and the ICC in particular, as I was trying to say that Palestine has joined the ICC in 2016, and the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian state has requested the ICC to investigate Israeli crimes and Israeli crimes against humanity and war crimes, and also the crime of aggression against the Palestinian people in terms of Israeli settlement activity in the occupied Palestinian territory, and also crimes against Palestinian civilians, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank. And unfortunately, the ICC has failed until now to investigate seriously Israeli crimes. And well, Israel has said that it will not allow ICC investigators to enter the Palestinian occupied territory, since it's under Israeli control. But at least the ICC can enter the Gaza Strip from the Egyptian territory, where Israel has no control whatsoever on the border between Gaza and Egypt. So that is one case where ICC prosecutor and IC investigators can come to the Gaza Strip and investigate Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. But also what I was trying to say that within a year, the ICC has moved in a very speedy way to investigate crimes against humanity and war crimes in Ukraine in only 1 year. But it has failed for the past 7 years to investigate in a very serious way Israeli crimes. And as we just saw, the ICC issued an arrest warrant against Russian President Vladimir Putin, and no arrest warrant has been issued by the ICC against any Israeli official or against any Israeli army commanders. While, as I just mentioned, that many international organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and also a special committee that was established by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate Israeli war crimes against Palestinian civilians in the Great March of Return of 2018 and 2019, where the head of that commission issued a statement that what happened basically account to war crimes. But in spite of all of the in spite of all of that, which is on the record, in spite of all the documents which has been provided by Palestinian human rights groups and international human rights groups to the ICC, until this moment, no arrest warrant or no serious investigation to begin with has been initiated in Israeli crimes against the Palestinian civilian population.
And as our guest in Vancouver also pointed out, well, the Israeli regime enjoys very strong support from the U.S., and we do remember investigators from the ICC trying to investigate war crimes in the occupied territories being under a lot of pressure by the U.S. government in particular to drop those investigations. So let's go back to our guest in Vancouver. Obviously, we are not going to see any kind of speedy ruling the way Professor mentioned from Gaza, like the case of Putin, for example, or we also remember Omar al-Bashir. We are not expecting that to happen, but in case we do see a ruling, how long is it going to take, in your opinion, and what is the value of this ruling? Of course, as you mentioned yourself, we're not expecting anything to be implemented based on that. The ICC does not have the power to implement its own rulings. So what are the consequences of that ruling?
Well, I think I just wanted to... I agree with the professor in terms of his analysis on Hamas' role and that it cannot... persuade this. Even Palestinian popular organizations could have a campaign to do this. It's important, in my view, more than the ruling itself, because the idea is to raise the awareness about the nature of the Zionist regime in Palestine, that it's a colonialist settler regime, and that Palestinians are fighting this colonialist project, not just Israel, but also Israel backers, particularly the United States and Western power. And we saw also that nothing, for example, was done when George Bush and Blair, committed war crimes in Iraq. Iraqis and Arabs remember very well when Madeleine Albright say that, killing 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it for oil companies. This is on record. And these warmongers have said that on record that Iraqis have been killed, not in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, but over 1.5 million innocent people. And nothing was done. Yet we saw, yesterday how they wanted to persuade a case against Putin. And before that, as you mentioned, Omar Bashir. Palestinians in general, they support exposing Israel on every international arena as long as this is not going to require certain, conditions on them or concessions, because the Palestinian cause is very just and it always enjoy international support in terms of, United Nations and other agencies. Our problem, my final comment, is the current Palestinian leadership. It is not a trusted leadership. It is not elected by the Palestinian people. Mahmoud Abbas and his cronies in Ramallah do not represent the Palestinian people. And so we want a united Palestinian leadership by the people, and we want Palestinian political bodies that is also by Palestinian people themselves. This is very important, and it gives any international campaigns by Palestinians a more credible than the current status.
Thank you very much. It's interesting that you should mention that. Let's bring in the professor. Professor, solidarity is the name of the game for Palestinians. They need to be united. And let's not forget that as we speak in Sharm el-Sheikh, there's a meeting underway. Let's see, in your opinion, how that meeting can help the Palestinians. Will it actually lead to any kind of alleviation of the suffering of Palestinians? How many times has Israel promised not to attack Palestinians, and still it has broken its promise?
Well, that is definitely a very important issue here. Let me remind you and remind your viewers that a meeting was held in Amman, in Jordan, Aqaba, 3 weeks ago on February 26th of this year, 2023. And supposedly the goal of that meeting was to de-escalate the tension between the Palestinians and Israelis. But over the past 3 weeks, Israel has committed many crimes, many incursions into the city of Jenin and the city of Nablus, killed many Palestinian civilians and many Palestinian fighters who belong to the Lion's Den or to the Jenin Battalion. And unfortunately, Israel did not respect the commitments that were made by Israelis and Palestinians during the Aqaba meeting 3 weeks ago. And today's meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, which also included the five parties, the U.S., Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority, and the goal also of today's meeting is to de-escalate the tension between the Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and also the Israeli occupation. But it doesn't seem to me that Israel is willing to respect its commitment in those understandings. The Palestinian delegation who met with the Israelis with the sponsorship of the U.S. is requesting Israel to put an end to its settlement expansion in the West Bank, to also put an end to its incursions into Palestinian areas classified as Area C, where the PA has total control. And also the Palestinians are asking Israel to release around half a billion U.S. dollar, which has been confiscated by the Israeli authorities, accusing the PA of sponsoring Palestinian martyrs and Palestinians who have participated in resistance against Israel. Overall, let me say that there is a popular and factional Palestinian opposition to the Sharm el-Sheikh meeting, which was convened today, as I mentioned, between the five members, the U.S., Israel, Egypt, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority. But let's wait and see whether those understandings will be respected by Israel or not. But I doubt it very much, because since the beginning of this year, more than 80 Palestinians have been killed and executed by the Israeli occupation forces, and Israel did not stop its settlement expansion or its appalling aggression against the Palestinian people. It seems to me that it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of effort by the U.S., Egypt, and Jordan to put pressure on Israel to respect its commitment and to alleviate the daily conditions of the 5 million Palestinians who live in West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem.
And the question that remains, Professor, is even if they do, can they stop Israel? Well, I'm sorry that we have we don't have much time to continue this discussion. Obviously, we need a lot more time. Our guest from Vancouver, thank you very much, Khaled Barakat, a journalist and activist, for joining us. Also, Mukaimer Abu Sada, professor of political science from Al-Azhar University. It was great to have you on this show, and of course, we definitely need to discuss this more. Thank you very much, and good night.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Kalam Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Our special guest speaker for today's discussion from the Islamic House of Qom is Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
So Ramadan is the best month of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We know that the months of Rajab, Sha'ban, and Ramadan were the best months considered by Prophet Muhammad. But Ramadan is the special month loved by Allah himself. It's called the month of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For today's discussion, we want to talk about the reasons why Ramadan is the best month of Allah in the Muslim calendar. Why is it so, Brother Suhail?
I would like to make an opening statement by mentioning the sermon of the last Friday of the holy month of Sha'ban,
okay. That
was given by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He states as, "O people, indeed ahead of you is the blessed month of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, a month of blessing, mercy and forgiveness, a month with which Allah is the best of month, its days the best of days, its nights the best of nights, and its hours the best of hours. It is the month which invites you to be the guest of Allah and invites you to be one of those near to Him. Each breath you take glorifies Him. Your sleep is worship. Your deeds are accepted and your supplications are answered." Now, why do we call this a blessed month? Is that we have some few points over here that we'd like to mention. One of them is that the Quran was revealed in this month. The night of power is in this month. According to the Holy Prophet and traditions that are there, verily the gates of heaven are opened on the first night of the month of Ramadan and are not closed again until the very last night. As soon as the month of Ramadan sets in, the